Welcome to the Corporate Social Responsibility Podcast. I'm your host, David Yosifan, Associate Professor of Law at Santa Clara University School of Law here in sunny Santa Clara, California. On the podcast today, we're going to be discussing the issue of lawyer fees in corporate law litigation, specifically the issue of fee shifting in corporate law litigation. Now, we are going to be discussing a specific controversy that has emerged in corporate law at the moment in this area, but it's my hope that this conversation will be useful and interesting to those who are interested in the question of fee shifting generally, or who are interested in corporate law fee shifting issues, but might be finding this podcast months or years down the road after this particular controversy has been settled. My guest today is Francis Pileggi, who is a lawyer from Delaware. He's member in charge at the law firm of Eckert Siemens in Wilmington, Delaware. And Francis also runs a blog on Delaware corporate law and Delaware corporate litigation. The blog is Delaware Litigation, all one word, DelawareLitigation.com. And it's a fantastic resource for lawyers and scholars who are interested in following on a day-to-day basis what is happening in Delaware litigation. Francis is a nationally recognized expert in Delaware corporate law, and I'm thrilled to have him on the podcast today to talk about the question of fee shifting in corporate law litigation. Francis, thanks for being a part of the podcast.
Thank you, Professor. Thank you for having me.
So the traditional rule in American law is that parties pay their own legal fees. Win or lose, you pay your own legal fees. Now, in lots of different contexts, that rule is altered, but that's the basic starting place. And for a long time, that has been the presumption in corporate law litigation, where shareholders are suing directors accusing directors of violating fiduciary obligations that are owed to the corporation and its shareholders. The baseline rule has traditionally applied. That is, the plaintiffs pay their legal fees, at least theoretically, and the corporation pays its legal fee. In a fascinating and kind of ground-shaking case that was decided by the Delaware Supreme Court last year, a case called ATP Tour Incorporated versus Deutscher Tennisbund, the Delaware Supreme Court allowed to stand a Delaware corporation's bylaws that it had adopted that called for fee shifting in derivative litigation. That is, under the bylaws that this company had adopted, if a shareholder brought a lawsuit and lost, then they would have to pay the corporation's legal fees. That this bylaw endeavored to be responsive to long-standing concerns within the business law community, or at least among corporate directors, that shareholder litigation is a nuisance and is costly to the corporation, and this fee-shifting bylaw was an effort to deter that kind of litigation. I think to many people, many observers' surprise, the Delaware Supreme Court upheld that the legitimacy of that bylaw, that fee-shifting bylaw under Delaware corporate law. And since that opinion came down, observers have been watching very closely to see what the Delaware legislature would do. How would it respond? Would it countenance the Delaware Supreme Court's permission that it granted corporations to adopt fee-shifting bylaws, or would it reverse them? And very recently, the Delaware legislature has come out with its proposal on fee shifting. And Francis, I'll ask you to describe the substance of what the Delaware legislature is now proposing, and perhaps we can get into the process by which they developed it.
Okay, thank you, Professor. So the proposed legislation, which was formulated by a group of Delaware lawyers, part of the corporation law section of the Bar Association, would, in essence, and I'm paraphrasing now, but in essence, it would prohibit corporations from adopting as part of their bylaws or their certificate of incorporation a provision that would require stockholders to pay the fees of the corporation in litigation by the stockholder against the corporation if the stockholder lose or lost. If the stockholder loses a lawsuit, then the legislation will prohibit the corporation from forcing the corporation to make the stockholder pay for the fees. That's sort of a simplified paraphrase of what the legislation would do, which in effect would basically override the Delaware Supreme Court's decision in the ATP case that you mentioned.
And to my mind, when I saw that this is the direction that the Delaware legislature is taking to forbid fee shifting, I was quite surprised that this is the direction that the legislature wants to go in, because of the fact that Delaware's corporate chartering business is so valuable to the state of Delaware, and while many observers are concerned about fee shifting, there's no question that corporations like it, or incumbent directors like fee shifting. And in order to remain attractive to directors and corporations, I would have guessed, I did predict that the legislature would countenance fee shifting. So I was quite surprised to see that they are now proposing to forbid fee shifting. What do you make of the justification for the legislature's move here, and was it surprising to you?
Well, there are a lot of constituencies involved. For example, it's not just when people say that corporations, for example, the DuPont Company is in support of bylaws or certificate of incorporation provisions that require fee shifting. So that would be an example of a major corporation based in Delaware, of course, that favors fee shifting and was opposed to legislation that would restrict fee shifting. But when you say corporations, that I do know better than most people, or maybe better than anybody, that corporation is not a monolithic one-person concept. There are many different constituencies and interest groups, for lack of a better phrase, that make up the corporation. There are institutional investors, for example. And institutional investors have come out in opposition to legislation that restricts fee shifting. And then there are lawyers, and they might not be technically a constituency of a corporation, but they are an important part of the analysis. And the lawyers who represent stockholders, who of course are constituents of a corporation, are concerned that the bylaws or charter provision that require fee shifting would, the conventional wisdom is that such provisions would chill or even prevent the filing of most lawsuits against directors. And there are those who believe strongly that even though there are many criticisms about too many stockholder lawsuits, the meritorious stockholder lawsuits are one of the only mechanisms in place to police directors who do not comply with their fiduciary duties. And there was a recent decision just a couple days ago, which make this conversation that we're having very timely. And it happened to be a case that I was representing a party in. It was a Delaware Court of Chancery opinion, and the name of the case was Strogo, Strougo, versus Hollander, Hollander. And that was a decision that just came out on Monday of this week, and I think that was maybe the 13th, it was the 16th. If my dates are correct. But anyway, it was a couple of days ago, and there was only dicta, but the dicta in that Delaware Chancery opinion by the Chancellor Bouchard, said that fee-shifting bylaws would immunize directors from being sued by stockholders who would not want to take the risk of an unlimited amount of fees that they would be responsible for if they lost, especially in a case where a stockholder had a relatively nominal amount of shares. So there is now, and that was the first pronouncement by any member of the Court of Chancery on what he really thought about fee-shifting bylaws, even though it was dicta and it was not a necessary part of the ruling in that case. So I bring that up to highlight the fact that there are some, including some members of the trial bench in Delaware, who think that fee-shifting bylaws are unfair because they will prevent directors from being held accountable by stockholders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and
now, I might have gone on too long and forgot if I answered all the other questions you might have had in that first question.
That's fantastic. That's great stuff, and I guess it's important for us to appreciate the subtlety or the complexity of the interest group dynamics, the political choice dynamics that operate there in Delaware. I think we often assume that Delaware legislature is going to be responsive to what corporations and their boards want, but you quite rightly draw our attention to other interest groups that have a role. But with respect to the question of value, the social value or the value to shareholders of derivative litigation, I've often tried to emphasize that in order to understand the value of shareholder suits, we need to look at we need to try to see the corporate misconduct that does not happen as a consequence of the availability or ubiquity of those lawsuits. That it's a mistake for us to say, well, if you know, we need to deter these lawsuits through fee shifting, because if you actually look at the lawsuits, they're not meritorious and they're just strike suits that operate as a tax against the shareholders on behalf of plaintiff's lawyers, because the kinds of conduct that corporations are being challenged for are, you know, that it's not real misconduct and that the lawsuits themselves are capricious. My view is that even if that's true, that we need not rest the justification for widespread availability of derivative litigation on the few meritorious cases of corporate misconduct, that in fact the real justification is the large amount of corporate misconduct of directorial malfeasance that never happens as a consequence of the impending threat or the constant threat of litigation. And if we diminish the availability of derivative litigation, then that misconduct that presently doesn't happen will be no longer deterred by shareholder litigation.
Right. That's a very good point. And I think that a corollary or supplement to what you said is worth highlighting, and that is there are some people who think wrongly that Delaware courts and the Delaware corporate statute are all pro-management, and they're all designed to favor management over any other constituencies like stockholders. But there are a couple reasons why that's not true, but I think this legislation might be an example of why it's not correct to say that the Delaware statute and the Delaware courts are only interested in favoring management. And I think that the reason is, among others, is because if they only favored management, eventually the stockholders, especially institutional investors, would move out of Delaware. Because if they were only favoring management to the detriment of stockholders, eventually enough stockholders would get together and say, well, this is not in our best interest to be in Delaware because the courts and the statutes are not concerned about us. And ultimately, they would be in a position to get enough of a majority together to reincorporate elsewhere. So I think that this is an example of an issue where management and stockholders can be seen to be on opposite sides of the issue, and it appears, anyway, that Delaware is poised to pass legislation that, at least it seems in some ways, is more favorable to stockholders on the surface, because it would be much, much, much more favorable to directors if the fee-shifting bylaws were the law of the land, and as you said, it would make them much less concerned about a risk of lawsuits because stockholders would be discouraged from filing them.
You know, and when you talk to Delaware, you hear Delaware jurists, and we actually had the governor here, Governor Markle, here at our law school, and he was touring Silicon Valley late last year, and you hear these luminaries of Delaware corporate law always insisting that their statute aims at balance, that it's not pro-management, and I think often observers are skeptical of that, but this kind of proves it, you know, that that this is a case where management clearly wants the fee shifting availability, and the legislature now is poised to forbid it. But let me ask you, as you're a Delaware native, you're from Delaware?
No, originally? Actually, I was born and raised in the suburbs of Philadelphia, but I went to grade school and high school and law school in Delaware, but I'm not a native.
All right. A Delawarean by choice, then,
yes.
And having made your career in Delaware corporate law, and obviously you're very deeply enmeshed in Delaware's corporate law operation. Some people are now wondering: is this going to be a moment where Delaware's monopoly or dominance in the purveyance of corporate law charters really is challenged, as other states, Oklahoma, I guess, is already announcing that its corporate laws permits fee shifting, and we can expect other states that have long tried to get a piece of Delaware's action in the sale of corporate charters, that many states are now going to be undoubtedly offering charters that allow fee mm-hmm. shifting. And is there worry in Delaware? Is there worry on the ground? I think there's, so conceptually, theoretically, this is going to be a really interesting natural experiment to see what happens. But so if you could address the conceptual issue, but also your perspective on the ground there in Delaware, is there real anxiety about what this is going to mean for Delaware dominance?
Those are all good questions, and I'll try to break it up into a couple parts. And the first part, I would say, is that you observed, Oklahoma, as I understand, has already passed legislation endorsing fee-shifting bylaws. And I'm not aware of a huge rush of major corporations to reincorporate in Oklahoma. But in addition to that, there are respected scholars and commentators on both sides of this issue. You may know or have heard about or read about one of your colleagues, in the sense that he's also a corporate law scholar like yourself, Professor Bainbridge, who has come down on the side of favoring fee-shifting bylaws. And there are other commentators who have strongly opposed fee-shifting bylaws. So the interesting thing about this case is that there are respected experts on both sides of the issue. And some of those experts say if Delaware passes this legislation, it's going to be the end of Delaware's dominance as a corporate haven, or a prominent corporate home for companies. And there are other people who are equally respected who say that if Delaware does not allow fee shifting bylaws, it will be the end of Delaware's prominence in corporate law. So it's one of those cases where there is, I would not describe it as an overwhelming majority of people who feel strongly in favor of one position as opposed to the other.
So there's just as much concern that Delaware could lose its chartering business if it allowed fee shifting.
Right. Right. Depending on who you talk to, whether
yeah.
it's the institutional investors, who, as you know, are a very strong force to be reckoned with.
Yeah.
And then there are the, associations of corporate directors who like the idea of fee-shifting bylaws. And then there are the lawyers. Yeah. And some people think that the lawyers are very selfishly concerned that it will reduce the number of lawsuits.
Mm-hmm.
And as you may know, I don't know if I'll call it the legal industry, but the various parts of the legal infrastructure, not only the franchise taxes that the state gets from companies that incorporate in Delaware, but through the court system, which brings in a lot of lawyers and a lot of other related revenue from hotels and restaurants and all the other things that lawyers use when they come out of town for litigation, because of Delaware being a forum where many people from other parts of the country and the world come to litigate their cases. That generates, according to some estimates, more than half of the state's annual budget.
Uh-huh. So it's not just the chartering, but the related related service industries, et cetera.
Right. So if fee-shifting bylaws or fee-shifting charter provisions are upheld, there's a concern that it will substantially reduce the amount of litigation that takes place in Delaware, which, among other things, even if nobody cares about the lawyers having less business, it will have a substantial, material, negative impact on the state budget. Now, compared to California, the Delaware state budget is probably negligible. I think it's a total of maybe $3 or $4 billion is the total state budget, and probably the city of Los Angeles has a bigger budget. But if a source of one half of that budget is being threatened, even if the governor cares less about the legal community, he's concerned about losing a substantial part of his annual state budget, the revenue that makes up half of that state budget. So that's sort of a non-legal economic aspect of this whole issue that is probably outside the realm of our discussion, but it's worth noting that that's another interest group, for lack of a better word, that's very much concerned with the outcome of how this all pans out.
It's really at the core of this conversation, of what this conversation needs to be about, you know, is to understand the political dynamics, the interest group dynamics, and that go into the promulgation of these kinds of rules, and then looking at what the social consequence of them is. You know, for listeners that might be a touch confused about why it is that Delaware dominates, I'll just state now, and we can discuss, you know, broader issues in another podcast, that the rule in the United States is that a corporation can choose its state of incorporation, doesn't have to have its principal place of business there, doesn't need to produce there or employ any workers there. A company can get its corporate charter from any one of the states. And we have not had in our history federal chartering of corporations, which has been discussed from time to time in our political history in the 19th century during the Progressive Era, but has not, the issue of federal chartering rather than state-based chartering has not really been a prominent national political issue in the late 20th or here in the early 21st century, even when we had the corporate crises of 2002 that resulted in Sarbanes-Oxley and the subprime mortgage debacle of 2008 that resulted in the Dodd-Frank reforms. Neither one of those major federal reform efforts even touched on the question of federal chartering and whether federal chartering could be a response to some of our broad corporate regulation problems. I wonder if this might be an occasion that resuscitates a broad conversation about federal chartering, given that we really may see a destructive competition among the states on this issue of fee chartering.
That's a very good point that you make. And one of the concerns that Delaware always has about maintaining its prominence is that the Congress will encroach more than it has. Little by little over the years, it has encroached with the Dodd-Frank and some other legislation that that you mentioned and then you're aware of, little by little, the federal Congress has dipped its toe, for lack of a better word, into the arena of regulation of corporations to the extent that it has typically been a state law arena. And there is concern, I think Professor Coffey might be one of the people who has suggested that if Delaware doesn't do something about it, that it's possible that Congress might see it as an opportunity to encroach further into areas that are typically governed by state corporation law. So there are a lot of different factors at work here, and there are a lot of it's one of those that is one of those issues. Some people have said it's one of the most important proposed amendments to the Delaware state Delaware general corporation law in several generations. And typically, I might add, just as a side note, the Delaware general corporation law is typically amended every year. Most of the time, there are small refinements, just little aspects that tweak it a little bit, just to update it in some respects, to adopt to some recent developments in the law, or to clarify something that may have been addressed in a case. And typically, those amendments are passed without discussion, without debate. They are just routinely adopted by the Delaware legislature. And why is that? Because it works. And if one of those amendments was passed without debate, without discussion, and it backfired for purely political reasons, having nothing to do with the law, the next year that the Bar Association proposed an amendment, I'm sure it would not go through as smoothly. But that hasn't happened, as far as I know, in generations. This one is different. This proposed amendment to the Delaware General Corporation Law will undoubtedly not be approved without debate or without discussion. This will be the subject of an enormous amount of debate and discussion. And unlike most amendments to the Delaware General Corporation Law, I don't think it will be easy to predict the outcome, number one. And number two, most of those amendments, routine amendments to the Delaware General Corporation Law, are passed without any change whatsoever. But this is going to be more like other legislation, which changes frequently from the date that it is introduced until the date it is passed. So you're never quite sure what the final version will look like. And I guess there's even a risk that it won't pass. I mean, last year, after the May 2014 Supreme Court decision in ATP, there was legislation proposed to prevent fee shifting bylaws, but because the legislature ends on June 30th, there wasn't enough time to debate it or to discuss it. So the resolution by the Senate was to consider it further in the next legislative session. So,
yes,
I'm probably going a little bit far afield, no, but I just thought I'd give you that background.
No, this is what we're interested in. And you know, when Governor Markell was out here, he talked with us about how the legislature had tabled the issue, and that he was pleased that they wanted to study the question quite deliberately, and as we in various settings tried to get him on the record with respect to fee shifting, he was quite savvy and I think sincere in declining to go on the record because he wanted to see the issue studied, and he studied further. Has the governor gone on record with respect to this proposed legislation, and do you think that he'll sign it?
That's a good question. I think that he will sign whatever comes through the legislature. I don't think he is going to be a passive spectator. I think that in during the process of legislative debate, he will make his position known. And I think whatever, if anything is passed, whatever is finally passed, I think will reflect his views. So I don't know that he has officially come out to endorse any particular legislation on this point. I think he's taken a a wait-and-see approach, because he knows it's important and he knows that there are respected people on both sides of the issue.
Right. Now, you quite rightly, I think, say that this is being considered one of the most momentous questions, and I think a really dangerous time, not just for Delaware, but for our corporate law architecture generally. You know, my own view, my own perspective is that absent the availability of shareholder suits, our well-functioning corporate law, our well-functioning corporations, which I think, you know, cynicism aside, that our corporations are typically pretty ethically run and pretty effectively run. But in my view, that's in part because of the omnipresent threat of litigation, and that absent that litigation, we're going to see a breakdown in the effective and proper and ethical operation of our corporations. So I agree this is a momentous time, but let me ask you, why is that time happening now? One of the mysteries to me as the ATP case came down was, it's been known for decades that business people and defense side lawyers, consider shareholder suits to be capricious and distracting and a tax and a drag on corporate productivity, and they're always looking for ways to get to avoid these lawsuits. And so why did it take until 2014 for this innovation of the adoption of bylaws to shift fees and to threaten plaintiffs' lawyers with having to pay corporate legal fees. Why has it taken so long for this question to come up?
That's an excellent question. I'm not sure I have an excellent answer for you, but I'll try.
Nobody's had a good answer for me yet, so even a bad answer will be better than what we've presently got.
I can only guess, and that is that nobody in Delaware anyway expected that the Delaware Supreme Court would uphold such a provision.
Uh-huh.
And there might be a selfish reason too, because most lawyers know that would reduce the amount of litigation, which would not be good for most lawyers. So first of all, I don't think anybody reasonably expected the Supreme Court to uphold such a provision. Second of all, they may have had some selfish motive for not wanting to promote that type of a provision. And thirdly, even though there was a surprise that the Supreme Court adopted it, as you can see now for the Fast and Furious, you can see from the Fast and Furious legislative efforts to override the Delaware Supreme Court decision, if nothing else, that reflects the position of a powerful, at least some powerful constituencies that are going to make sure that type of a provision does not continue to be recognized as a valid provision.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if I've answered your question or not, but that's the best I can do. But
no.
But it is a good question, and I'm not sure there's a good answer to it.
Yeah, well, that is a good and interesting answer from the perspective of Delaware, certainly. I'm still left with the mystery of why states that have long been looking to compete with Delaware haven't tried this one out, previously. And it may just be a question of, I sort of think it's quaint. It's a quaint comment on the human condition that if there's some explanation is that people just didn't think of it, that this is that,
right.
That this simply hadn't been imagined.
Yeah, I don't know if this is a good example, but it's like Starbucks. It's a very simple concept, right?
Coffee there you shop. Go. That's right.
Why didn't anybody think of having a nationwide or worldwide chain of coffee shops before
that's
the
right.
last 10 years?
That's right. Well, it's the old economic the academic economist's tale that where there's a the economist and his student or her student is walking down the street, and there's and the student points out and says, "Oh, look, professor, there's $20 bill laying on the sidewalk," and the professor just keeps walking, and the student rushes up to the professor and says, "Well, why didn't you pick it up?" And the professor says, there couldn't have been a $20 bill on the ground. If there had been, somebody would have picked it up already. And of course, my version of that, I also teach legal ethics in addition to business law. And my version of that goes like this, where there's a partner at a law firm and a young associate are walking along the sidewalk. And the associate says, "Oh, look, there's a $20 bill on the ground," but the partner keeps walking. The associate scurries up to the partner and says, "There was a $20 bill on the ground. Why didn't you pick it up?" And the partner says, "It wasn't worth my time." That is, I need a better punchline, but that is that my hourly rate is worth more than it would have cost me to bend over and pick up the 20. So I don't know if that any of that explains this innovation of fee shifting. But if we can get further perspective from you being on the ground there in Delaware, can you talk with us about the Delaware Corporate Law Council and its role in developing or innovating Delaware corporate law? It has a somewhat mythic status for us in 3,000 miles away, observing Delaware corporate law. Can you tell us a little bit about, for our listeners, introduce what the council does, and then if you can give us kind of a real perspective on the operation of the council from your work there in Delaware?
Sure. The first thing I'd like to point out is that it is representative of lawyers who represent both stockholders and directors and in-house counsel of corporations. So it's a fair cross-section of lawyers who represent all the various constituencies and interest groups that
And that's genuine. And by your observation, that's genuine, because we hear that, but then I think we often think that that's probably not true, that it's probably dominated by one interest or another. But by your observation, it is a well-balanced enterprise.
Yes, I think it's well balanced, and over the years, some people might say, "Well, the attorneys who represent the directors are the more powerful members of the committee," and at different times, the reverse might be true. I think that off the record, and I know this isn't off the record, but I don't care if I say it on the record. I think at times, because some people have stronger personalities than others. Some people mm-hmm. have more political connections than others.
Yeah.
At some points, let's say over the past 30 years, there may have been, even though there's always been a cross-section of lawyers representing various interest groups, at some points over the past 30 years, some of the members of the committee who represent directors might have had stronger personalities and more political clout. I think at the current time, there's an observation to be made that some of the members on the committee who represent mostly plaintiffs and stockholder class actions are among the members of the committee with the strongest personalities and the strongest political ties. But that doesn't mean if there's a fair cross-section. It just means in any group, there are going to be some people who are more forceful, more persuasive, more well-liked. And so they have more influence. But the process is that group, which is elected by members of the Bar Association, there's a corporate law section. So the corporate council is a subgroup of the corporate law section of the Bar Association. And they are tasked every year with trying to find ways to make the Delaware General Corporation law better. And sometimes it just means small refinements. Sometimes it means just tweaking things. I think a couple of years ago, there was a move to make the statute more gender neutral, for example, which was fairly innocuous. And the way the process works is after the council comes up with their proposal, it goes to the corporation law section for their approval. And then after they approve it, the executive committee of the full Delaware State Bar Association approves it. Or not. Typically, it gets approved. And then after the Bar Association Executive Committee approves it, then it goes to the legislature. And routinely, the legislature approves it without discussion, without debate. But as we mentioned before, this year it's going to be different because there will be debate and there will be a lot of discussion. But that's the process, how it works mm-hmm. procedurally.
And so you get on this corporate council is really a matter of It does showcase the influence of lawyers in the process that is not as compared to, for example, business people, labor or consumers or environmental groups, that the corporate law council is comprised of lawyers and elected by lawyers.
Correct. And the participation of the non-lawyers would come at the legislative process. And even though typically most people don't get involved in it because it's usually arcane and esoteric and not very controversial. This time, the non-lawyers will be participating during the legislative process in the form of lobbying. You can be sure that institutional investors have their own lobbyists. I know that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has been very vocal in favor of fee-shifting bylaws, so they would be opposing the legislation. Companies like the DuPont Company and other major trade groups, for lack of a better word, for large companies, I'm sure will have their lobbyists. So Dover, Delaware, which, as you know, is the capital of Delaware, will be swarming with major lobbyists on both sides of the issue. So I think in this particular instance, non-lawyers will have a seat at the table and will be expressing their opinions.
I want to raise one further theoretical point just here to hear your reaction to it as well, is that I think that commentators have been speculating and saying for years now that institutional investors, activist investors, activist shareholder groups, in the guise of, you know, of institutional investors, I'm not talking about sort of idiosyncratic activist groups, but, you know, real institutional investors have been having a greater say or greater voice in corporate governance, formally and informally, and in the promulgation of regulations that affect corporate governance. And I think this perhaps really brings that home or showcases just the power of institutional investors if they have been able to have their perspective shown, that they want, they don't want fee shifting. They want the traditional American rule that they don't want fee shifting where shareholders in a failed lawsuit have to pay the corporation's legal fees. But I guess the question, it raises a question about private ordering and why institutional investors can't otherwise get what they want. That is, if institutional investors are so powerful, then you would think that they could punish corporations who decline to adopt, they could punish corporations that do adopt fee-shifting bylaws, or corporations that are chartered with fee-shifting provisions, that institutional investors could punish these firms by not investing in them or by exiting them in favor of firms that that embrace the traditional rule and don't have fee-shifting provisions. So the question is really, why do institutional investors need the law to protect them against fee-shifting? Why isn't their strength in the marketplace sufficient to get them the rule on lawyer fees that they prefer?
That's a very good point. They could vote with their feet and just de-invest or divest their holdings in companies that have fee-shifting bylaws. And I suppose that it's a good question, and it's another good question I don't have a good answer for, but my best attempt will be to say that since, as you know, the majority of Fortune 500 companies and the majority of companies on the New York Stock Exchange and the majority of IPOs are Delaware companies, that might take some time for them to divest, and they may not want to divest in companies, majority of whom are on the New York Stock Exchange or part of the Fortune 500. It would reduce the number of eligible companies that they would want to invest in. And maybe that's the only good answer I can.
Yeah, I think that's a great explanation, or perhaps it is testament at least to the view of institutional investors that that the market isn't always efficient, and sometimes we need the law to supply the efficient or desirable rule rather than relying on the market to produce it. Well, I know that you are licensed in several states: Delaware, New Jersey, New York. Am I right?
Delaware, Pennsylvania, New Jersey.
Okay, Delaware, Pennsylvania, New Jersey. But I take it that you are not. Are you going to be studying for the Oklahoma bar this summer, or not?
That is a good question. Well, if there is a major exodus of Delaware companies to Oklahoma, I may at least need to look into whether or not they have reciprocity with Delaware, or opposite for another example.
Okay, great. I'm sensing there is an abject panic in among Delaware corporate lawyers that there's going to be a rush out of Delaware that's really going to compromise Delaware's traditional dominance in this area.
I wouldn't say there's panic, but they're responsible and respected people on both sides of this issue. And there are people who say if fee-shifting bylaws are allowed and endorsed in Delaware, that there will be an exodus. There are other people who say that unless legislation is passed to restrict fee-shifting bylaws, there will be an exodus. So nobody knows for sure if there will be an exodus either way. So I don't know if it's panic. I think there's a great deal of concern that this is an important issue. The problem is not everybody agrees on what to do about it.
Well, there's going to be continued debate, I think, all through the as Delaware takes this up. I guess in June they're going to be taking this up, or this
June 30th is the end of the legislative session, and sometimes that's the early morning hours of July 1st. But typically, difficult legislation like this is done on the last day,
and this
they can't agree to do it any sooner.
Right. Okay. Well, this will be whatever Delaware does ultimately do, I guess, will be the next chapter, but it certainly won't be the final chapter. We'll wait to see what other states do and whether the federal government, right. I guess the federal government could really rescue Delaware here by stepping in through promulgating securities regulation, which prohibits fee shifting as a matter of federal law, though I'm not sure that Delaware wants to look to the federal government to produce any more corporate law than it already has. But we'll continue to look to it.
Regardless of your political persuasion, you just reminded me of I don't know which president, probably a Republican president, said that the most dangerous words that you can ever hear someone say is that I'm from the government and I'm here to help you.
Right. Yeah. I think that was Ronald Reagan.
I don't know if that's the Delaware view of somebody from Congress saying that we're happy to help you out with this situation.
Right. Well, I think that typically that's a conservative or a Republican viewpoint, but I think undoubtedly in Delaware that's a bipartisan perspective.
Yeah. And you know, one last quick point I might want to make is,
please,
if there is legislation passed that prohibits fee shifting bylaws, one source of litigation will be what happens to all the companies, and there are at least a few dozen who have already adopted fee shifting bylaws. How does the legislation impact that? You know better than anybody that the typical rule is that legislation is not retroactive, especially when it deals with contracts. So it's anybody's guess how that will pan out, right?
Well, I'm sure lawyers will look forward to litigating that matter. But
that will be short-lived because there's a finite number of companies who have done it. So
right. Well, yeah.
Unless you're near retirement, you can't bank on that for the rest of your career.
Right. Okay. Well, I also just want to, Francis, I want to thank you for your time. I hope that we can check back in with you as this issue develops, and I want to.
Sure. Please do.
And I just want to promote your blog, which is really a fantastic resource, I think, for lawyers and scholars alike. Anyone interested in developments in Delaware, it's DelawareLitigation.com. That's right? DelawareLitigation.com.
Yes. Thank you so much, Professor. I appreciate the opportunity, and I hope we have a chance to talk again.
Okay, my pleasure, Francis. Thank you. All right, that does it for this episode of the Corporate Social Responsibility Podcast. My thanks to Francis Pileggi. for sharing his insight and experience and predictions on this issue with us. And we will check back in with him as these matters develop in Delaware and beyond. You can follow us on Twitter at David Yosifon. That's at David Yosifon, at David Yosifon. And I tweet it out whenever we post a new episode on the Corporate Social Responsibility Podcast. We are sponsored by the Markle Center for Applied Ethics here at Santa Clara University, and we are grateful for their sponsorship. And also follow the podcast or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you want to comment on any of our episodes, you're very welcome to do so through Twitter, or contact me about any of the episodes through Twitter, or ideas that you might have for future episodes in this podcast series. As always, thank you for listening. I'll talk with you next time. Boomer lives.